Well, good morning. Some of you guys are still sleepy from the tryptophan that you ingested this week. That's the chemical that turkeys, you know, give off, make you sleepy. Anyways, bad joke. I'm sorry. Apologize. Good morning. Glad you're here this morning. I know it's maybe take us a little bit longer to wake up this morning. It's hard coming back from Thanksgiving, y'all. I'm going to be honest. My name is Pastor Aaron. I'm the youth pastor here at Bentonville Community Church, and we are so glad that you joined us today for worship. Over the last few weeks, we've been talking about different characters that we find in the New Testament and what their role is, and we've just kind of done a little bit of a character study on these guys and these gals. So today, we're going to continue that, and we're going to be talking about a man named Jairus in the New Testament. Jairus, found in Mark chapter 5, if you have your Bible and you want to turn there, we're going to be in chapter 5, verses 21 through 24, and then 35 through 43, and you could kind of follow along as we walk down this road. She was his only child. She was his only child. He had kind of secretly wished for a little boy. He kind of secretly wished that maybe God would bless him with this little boy that could follow in his footsteps, carry on his name, and kind of take over his role in the synagogue. But instead, God gave him a little lamb. God gave him a little girl. She was his only child. She would never open the scroll to read the scriptures in the synagogue, and she would no doubt one day change her name to match her husband's. She had her mother's eyes and her father's nose. Sure, a little boy would have been nice, but she was the light of his life, and nothing could have taken her place. At this point, she was 12 years old now, and in that culture, from 0 to 11 years in one day, you were considered a child. And from 11 years in one day to 12 years in one day, you were considered underage. And then by about 12 and a half, you were considered an adult. And so she was 12 years old. She was close to marrying age. She was close to that age. In fact, there were freshly bar mitzvahed boys that were lining up at Jairus' door already asking for her hand in marriage. Jairus was kind of a big deal. He was kind of a big deal. But it didn't seem possible to Jairus that she could be that age. And I know several of you in this room can relate to that with children. Can't imagine how your children are already the ages that they are. But he just remembered going in the backyard making mud pies with his daughter. He remembers going and being there. He remembers putting out money to make sure that she had the best tutor. She had the best education. She had the best things available to her. He put out money for piano lessons, and he put out money for braces, and all these things seem to have paid off, because now here she is. She's 12 years old, and she's marrying age, and there's boys lined up asking for her hand in marriage. And, it was a good thing. Jairus loved his little lamb. See, Jairus was an important man. He was an important man, and like all Jewish children, his name was intentional and carefully selected. His name literally meant the awakener. The awakener, Jairus, the awakener. And he more than lived up to his name. You see, Jairus had worked his way up the political and religious ladder until he now held the highest honor for a Jewish man in that city. He was the leader of the synagogue. He was in charge. He was the head honcho, right? And in that culture, that was a big, big deal. And so that's Jairus. That's who he is. He had clout. He was respected. He was the top rung of success. He had wealth, position, and privilege. Everything had just kind of fallen into place for Jairus. Sounds like a pretty awesome guy. Sounds like a guy that a lot of us probably can relate to. And as I look at you here in this room, I can see many Jairuses in this room. I see many Jairuses in this room who have a great job. You've got a great family. Things have kind of fallen into place for you in your life. And that's awesome. And that's really great. I can see myself in Jairus at certain times. This past week, as I was able to reflect on all the things I have to be thankful for in my life, I was reminded just how blessed I really am. I was reminded of that. I was reminded of all the things that God has just placed in my lap. And so I can find myself, I can relate to Jairus. I can understand where he was at. I can understand that. See, every night this past week, it's something kind of funny. Every night this past week, my son, Brody, he said, you know, hey, let's go around the circle and everybody say something that they're thankful for. So, okay, that's a great idea, buddy. So we go around and of course he starts and he's like, I'm thankful for everything. And we're, okay, well, yeah. Kind of hard to one-up you there, buddy. So we go around, he says, I'm thankful for everything. And I say, you know, I'm thankful for my family. Carly says, you know, I'm thankful we have shelter and a house to live. And we, you know, Brecken doesn't say anything because he's only 7 months old. But then we get to Peyton, and Peyton sits there and she goes, I'm thankful for cookie dough. And we were like, yes, you are. And then Brody's like, hey, let's go around again. So we go around again. And we get back to her again, and she's like, I'm thankful for mac and cheese. And we're like, this girl likes food, I guess. So, but we're reminded of these things, and we're reminded of the blessings in our lives whenever we take time, like we did this past week, to be thankful. And so it's just kind of funny, but I find myself in Jarius's position. I remember sitting there as Peyton said cookie dough and just laughing and thinking it was funny and just being so blessed in that moment. In so many ways, I can see the good life that God has given me. I can share the success of Jarius, and I'm sure that many of you in this room can relate. Many of you can relate. And all of Jarius' success was fantastic, but on this morning, none of it could help him. In fact, on this morning, none of it even seemed important. You see, upstairs, in a bedroom of his house on this cliffside manor, he had a child, his only child, his little lamb. She was burning up with fever. She had infection. And if you've ever spent the night next to a child or someone that's been burning up with fever, it's just a helpless scenario. You feel very helpless in that moment. You want to do anything you can to just take that away from that child, but the reality is that there's not much you can do. So Jarius, he's sitting there beside her bed and she's burning up with fever. And at this point, this has been going on for a while now. And his wife is starting to get nervous. His wife is starting to wonder what's going to happen. And Jarius is trying to maintain calm. He's trying to be the strong one. He's trying to say, it's going to be okay, honey. It's going to be fine. She's going to be all right. But inside, he's breaking. Because he knows in the back of his mind that this is serious. You see, this boy, he's a man of wealth. He's respected around town. And so they've brought in all of the best physicians that they can, all of the best doctors that they can, and nothing seems to be working. The infection still seems to be there. You see, she had been sick before. She'd had chicken pox and dozens of colds and maybe even a broken arm, but nothing like this. Nothing like this. This time it was different. This time nothing was helping. They prayed every prayer that they knew, but God still seemed far away. Finally, Jarius couldn't stand it anymore, and he went outside on his balcony that overlooked the sea there. He couldn't stand it anymore, and he had to get out of the room because he's breaking inside. He's trying to maintain his strength. But on this morning, he had to take a break. So he walked out on his balcony, and he stood there, and he looked out over the water. He looked out over the water, and his eyes were puffy. His body was tired. There was a certain numbness to him. And I don't know about you guys, but I can also relate to this Jarius. I can also relate to this Jarius. See, he wasn't thinking about his status that morning. Wasn't thinking about it at all. And it's funny how insignificant all of our success and social status seem in the face of death. All of those things seem so insignificant in the face of death. And Jarius would have given everything he had, all of that success, all of that wealth, he would have given it all for his daughter to get up out of that bed and walk around healthy. He would have done that. So there he sat, staring out at the sea, helpless and hopeless. Have you ever been there with Jarius? Helpless and hopeless. Suddenly, you know, you find yourself in this situation where just doesn't seem like things are falling into place like they usually do. Or you're telling yourself that it's going to be okay, but just, it never gets okay. That's where Jairus was. He found himself there. So there he sat, staring out at the sea. When suddenly the stillness is broken by the sounds of shouting and cheering and celebration. He hears it, and Jairus is thinking, well, it's like 9 o'clock in the morning. I don't know what's going on that people are so excited about. And so as he stands and he walks over to the edge of his balcony, he hears the shouts and the cries, and the celebration gets louder. And he walks closer to the edge of his balcony, and soon he's like, wow, this something is going on, and it's a big deal. He stares over the edge of his balcony, and he sees the shore. He looks out at the shore, and he sees just a mass of people. It looks like the whole town has come out to the sea's edge. And suddenly it hits him. The only thing that this many people are going to show up for at 9 o'clock in the morning is Jesus. See, Jesus has traveled across the lake, and now he's there. He's there at the shore, and the whole town has come out to greet him. It's the only thing it could be. You see, Jesus was back in town, and Jairus knew Jesus well. The reports of his ministry had spread like wildfire throughout the region. Jairus himself had given Jesus permission to teach in his synagogue. And what a teaching it was. It was incredible. Everywhere Jesus went, things happened. People's lives were changed. Relationships were restored. And the sick had been healed. And just like that, Jairus thinks, wait, the sick are healed. And as quickly as he can, he runs back into his house and he changes his clothes. He's still got on his pajamas, and so he takes those off and he puts on his official robes. He's a synagogue leader, so he puts on his official robes and he takes off running out the door. Because there's a crowd of people down there and he knows Jesus is there. And in his mind, he's got one thing on his mind. I've got to get Jesus to my little girl. I've got to get Jesus to my little lamb. And so he takes off running, and you can imagine it's been a while probably since Jairus has run like this. And he's stumbling over his official robes, and he kind of looks a little goofy running down the street in these robes. But it didn't matter to him. How he looked in that moment didn't matter. It didn't matter what his clothing looked like. He did not care. He didn't care if he looked like a fool running. He didn't care if he tripped and fell a dozen times. He was going to get to Jesus. He was going to get to Jesus. Because he knew time was running out. Time was running out. The crowd was as large as he'd ever seen. The whole town must have been out, down by the shore. And so he gets to the edge of the crowd and he begins to try to make his way through. And it's loud, y'all. It's really loud. It's really loud. People are shouting. People are laughing. People are cheering. They're excited for this man, Jesus, who's here. Because, as I said, relationships are restored. Things are changed. Things are different when he's around. And so Jairus is at the edge of the crowd, and I can just see it. This dignified man begins to pull people and push them and try to get them out of his way as he tries to make his way to Jesus. And I don't know if you can imagine this, but I can imagine at some point people don't realize who it is that's pushing him, and they're grabbing and pulling, and maybe even his official robe gets ripped. I don't know. But can you picture this scene with me? Jairus is making his way through the crowd, and he's pushing, and he's trying to get through, and it's loud, and all of a sudden, people begin to realize who's pushing their way through, and there's like this hush that kind of falls over the crowd. It gets real quiet. And people at this point, they're kind of like, what is he doing here? Because he's the leader of the synagogue. He doesn't need to push his way through this crowd. Right? He has let Jesus come to his pulpit and take his pulpit. He's got a relationship there. What does he need from Jesus? So there's this hush that falls over the crowd, and Jairus continues to push his way through, and he's still stumbling at this point, falling, not really caring at all how he looks in the process. See, it's uncharacteristic for a man of his position to do what he was doing. See, he began to beg and plead with Jesus. He's coming, even from a long way off, he's saying, Jesus, please. He's still pushing through the crowd. And all of a sudden, he stumbles and he falls at the feet of Jesus, and he stands up and he's face to face with Jesus. And there's this look in Jesus' face this look of compassion, this look of love. And Jairus breaks down in the moment. All of the strength that he could muster to try to keep himself together is now gone. And he no longer can hold himself together as he falls to his knees at the feet of Jesus. Falls to his knees at the feet of Jesus, and he pleads with Jesus. He begs Jesus, which is unbecoming on a man of his position, his stature. But Jesus is standing there, and Jairus is at his feet, and Jairus doesn't care what he looks like. He says, "Jesus, it's my daughter. She's dying. Please come to her. I've seen you do it before. I know you can do it again. If only you would just place your hands on her, I know she will live." Filled with compassion, Jesus says, "Okay, take me to her." And all of a sudden, I don't know if you guys can picture this in your heads or not, but to me, in my head, I see this scene playing out. And Jesus says, "Okay, take me to her." And Jairus, I can imagine, he's just overcome with joy. He stands up. He begins to wipe tears from his eyes. He just grabs Jesus' hand, and he begins leading him, trying to get him through the crowd. And as they're on their way, the disciples, this crowd is very large. And all of a sudden, with this proclamation that Jesus says, "Okay, take me to her," the crowd erupts. They're excited. They want to see the miracle man work a miracle. And so they're trying to press in around Jesus. They're trying to follow where Jesus is going. The disciples are trying to make a path. They're trying to move people out of the way. And all of a sudden, there's this other thing that happens in the middle of this story with this woman who touches his robe. And so Jesus stops, and I can only imagine at this moment what Jairus is thinking. Jairus is going, "Oh no, time is running out. Jesus, please, we gotta go." But Jesus takes his time with this woman, and when he turns back to Jairus, Jairus is, he's watching Jesus, and he turns to walk the other way, and all of a sudden he sees a few of his servants coming towards him in this moment. And they look out of breath, and they look like they've just seen a ghost. And in that moment, Jairus' heart just sinks. It sinks. And his servants come to him, and they say, "Master Jairus, it's your daughter. I'm so sorry, she's dead. There's no need to bother the teacher anymore." And I can't imagine what that might feel like for Jairus in that moment, just paralyzed by fear, not being able to even move or speak to Jesus even. Have you ever felt like Jairus? Have you ever been in that situation, that desperation situation, and you've been telling yourself things are going to be okay, things are going to be okay, and then all of a sudden the servants come and they say, "I'm sorry, I'm so sorry." Jairus is paralyzed for a moment, but I've felt like Jairus before. I remember we were living in Houston, and we hadn't been there very long. We'd been there not quite a year yet. And I remember getting a call from my parents that my grandfather had gone to the hospital. They had gone to Dallas to visit my aunt and uncle, and while they were there, he had to go into the hospital. And at first it was like, okay, you know, he'll go into the hospital and things are going to be okay, but we pretty quickly learned that it was a lot more serious than what we had thought. And so there was a moment that came where I got a call from my parents, and they said, "You know what, he's not going to make it." And so I remember getting in the car, and Carly came with me, and I remember getting in the car, and we drove from Houston to Dallas to see my grandfather. And I knew walking into that hospital room, I knew that it was going to be the last time. I knew it was going to be the last time, and standing there beside his bed and holding his hand and seeing him in that situation, I felt that helpless and hopeless feeling I felt that feeling, and I felt what Jairus must have felt. I remember that feeling like, it's too late. Death has won, and I could do nothing to stop it. I remember that feeling, and death truly is the enemy. It's our greatest fear. And at some point, all of us feel like Jairus. We feel the defeat and the sting of death. We can all think back on loved ones and people close to us that we have lost, and that phrase is probably not far from our own cry in those moments. We can feel Jairus' pain, and in this greatest moment of pain, in Mark 5:36, he says this. He says, Jesus looks at Jairus and he says, don't be afraid, just believe. Don't be afraid, just believe. Now, I don't know what enabled Jairus in that moment to believe. I'm not sure. What would have enabled him to believe in that moment? How did he believe that Jesus was able to do something that before this moment, Jairus had never thought possible? How in the world is that going to happen? Jesus looks at him and he says, don't be afraid, just believe. It's not really recorded why Jairus believes him. But for the first time in Jairus' life, I believe that he began to believe that at the end of his possibility remained the possibility of God. At the end of him, there was more. The very first time in his life, I think he believed that, and he believed that Jesus could provide that. And that kind of hope is the kind of hope that Jesus offers us too. That's the kind of hope that we have in Christ Jesus our Lord. Friends, today, does your hope end at your possibility? Does your hope end at your possibility? Can you say that you have the kind of hope and faith in Jesus that Jairus had put into Jesus? I want you to know that because of Jesus, we have a hope that goes beyond all other kinds of hope. It is the hope of Jesus Christ, who was crucified, dead, buried, and counted out. Yet, on the third day, he shattered what everyone thought was possible when the stone was rolled away and he walked out as the risen Messiah. That is our hope. That is our hope. And that's the hope that Jesus, before any of that even transpired, is offering to Jairus. He's offering a resurrection hope. This is the kind of hope that's available to us today. It's the same kind of hope then as it is now. So by the time Jesus arrived at Jairus' house, you know, they've continued to press through the crowd. And he tells the crowd to stay there. He didn't want the crowd to follow him on. He tells most of his disciples to stay as well. He only takes three of his disciples with him, and they arrive at Jairus' house. Now, I can imagine Jairus is a man of stature. He's got this cliffside mansion, and people, professional mourners, were a thing then. They were a thing, and in fact, the custom of the day was that even the poorest man was to hire a minimum of two flute players and one professional mourner in the event of his wife's death. So you can only imagine what must have been required for the death of a synagogue leader's daughter. There must have been a lot of people around. And there was wailing, and it was loud, and it was people crying, and all kinds of commotion going on. It must have been quite the scene that Jesus walked in on. So there's these people, they've already started. They're already gathered there. You see, Jesus, in this moment, he faces these people and he says something to them in verse 39. He asks, why all the commotion for a child that is only sleeping? He asks, why all the commotion for a child that is only sleeping? And the word sleep in Greek is used in a couple of different ways. It's used in a literal sense, such as when Jesus fell asleep in the back of the boat. There's a storm going on in the sea and Jesus is sleeping below. It's used there in that reference. And then it's also used later when Paul is preaching, and he's preaching so late into the night, and there's this young man, he falls asleep, and he actually falls out the window, right? You guys are like, I can relate right now, Aaron, Pastor Aaron. But he uses, it's used in a literal sense, but then it's also used, as it is here, almost as a euphemism for death. It's used in this sense that, you know, we're going to use the word sleep instead of dead. And that's the sense that Jesus is using it here, because you see, Jesus knew she was dead, right? But all of the professional mourners, all of the people there, they seem to think he's using it in a literal sense because they begin to laugh. Like, listen, Jesus, we know dead, we're professionals. We know a dead person when we see them. And I'm telling you that she is not asleep. She is dead. And Jesus says, okay, well, take me to her, right? And they take Jesus upstairs into this bedroom. And, you know, Jesus said she was asleep because he wanted everyone to know that death never has the last word for those who belong to him. That's why he uses the word sleep and not dead. He wants people to know that death doesn't have the last word for those that belong to him. So as they all stood in the room, it was obvious by looking at her that she was, in fact, dead. She laid there pale, emaciated, and lifeless. It was quiet and still in the room. You could hear Jairus' wife sobbing quietly to herself. And Jairus, at this point, it's the first time he'd seen his daughter in this state, and so he begins to weep as well. It's just somber in the room. Jesus walks over beside Jairus' daughter. He walks over and he kneels down beside her bed. He kneels down beside her bed and he takes her hand. And then he speaks to her. He says, it's time to get up. Arise, little lamb. And with that, the little girl opened her eyes and began to breathe again. And can you imagine the first sight back from death being the face of Jesus right there at your bed? How awesome that must be. And then not only does she open her eyes and begin to breathe again, but she throws the covers off and she gets up out of bed and she begins to walk around the room. This is important because this is a sign that, look, this girl is fully healed. She's not just resuscitated a little bit. No, she is healed. She's been brought back to life by Jesus Christ. He's walked into this upstairs bedroom where there's been nothing but sadness for the last several days. There's been nothing but hopelessness and helplessness. And he steps into that situation and he provides hope. And he delivers on that hope. It's a pretty incredible scene, and I can only imagine what it must have been like to be there in the room. The cheers, the laughter, and what must the mourners who were downstairs, what must they have thought when all of a sudden this girl comes walking down the stairs? And I can imagine, you know, Jesus is probably pretty sarcastic. He's like, I told you, she was asleep. I can imagine that in my head. What an awesome scene it must have been. You see, Jairus, whose name means the awakener, witnesses the awakener in that moment. The awakener steps into his life and shows him what that looks like. He had just witnessed it. You see, it had looked like death had won, but because of hope, death does not prevail. Death does not prevail. And so that's a great story. And we find that there in Mark chapter 5. And so maybe you read that story and you're like, okay, but so what? It's a great story. That's a good story in the Bible, Pastor Aaron. What does that mean for me today? What does that mean for me today? You know, years and years and years ago, centuries ago, people thought the earth was flat, right? They thought the earth was flat. And Europeans, they would look out over the sea and they would see the sun set below the horizon. And they thought at that point, there was nothing there. If you sailed that far, you would drop off the edge, right? That's what people thought. That was common belief. Until a courageous young sailor, decided, hey, I think that there's more beyond all of that. People laughed at him. They thought he was crazy, right? And in fact, the motto of Spain at the time, it was ne plus ultra, which means there is nothing beyond, right? That was the motto of the Spanish Armada, that it was, there's nothing beyond. And so Christopher Columbus comes and he convinces people and to let him go, and he sets sail. And people watch him. You can imagine the crowd gathered at the shore, and they watch him sail off. And every day, you know, you kind of think, as they're walking around doing their daily business, they kind of glance off at the horizon to see if he's coming back or not. Or did he fall off the edge? But they go about their business. Until one day, they're walking around doing their normal business, and they look off at the distance, and they see a boat. That looks like Christopher Columbus's boat. It's coming back, right? It's coming back, and he gets back, and he tells them what's beyond what they can see. He tells them that, hey, look, you're not going to fall off the edge over there if you do that. And that day, the day that he comes back, they change their motto from there is nothing beyond to there is more beyond. There is more beyond. And so, for years, people like you and I have stood at gravesides and funerals, and we've wondered, is there anything beyond the dark waters of death? Then one day, a courageous adventurer named Jesus sails beyond the dark waters. And most people thought the dream was over and the evil had won the day. But 3 days later, on Resurrection Sunday, the sun rose and the Son of God stepped forth from the grave and declared that there is more beyond. Love conquers evil. Life conquers death. There is a Heavenly Father who will wipe away your tears. And that is what we call hope. For you and I, that's what we call hope. We're able to look back at the moment where Jesus surrenders himself on a cross and dies a death for you and I. And he goes to the edge of what we think is possible and steps beyond that. He takes our place. And because of that, there is more beyond this life. This morning, I don't know what you believe. I don't know exactly where you're at in your walk, in your journey on this in this life. But I do know this. I know that there is a God who loves you so much that he sent his only son to die for you so that he could offer you hope of eternal life with him. Maybe you've accepted Jesus already this morning, and this is just a good reminder that of what he did for us. I believe here in the story of Jairus and his daughter, I believe that Jesus is foreshadowing a little bit of what's to come. He's foreshadowing his own death and resurrection and letting people know that there is hope, there's more beyond. And so, this morning, the same is true. Today I want to ask you, where does your hope end? Does it stop where you do? Or do you have a hope that extends beyond? If you aren't sure, there's opportunity this morning. There's opportunity for you to open your heart to him, to accept the hope and to realize that the hope that is there for you. It's there for all of us if we'll just accept it.